I'm Stephen Downs.
And I'm Adam Rizvi.
And this is Letters to the Sky, a podcast about the metaphysical iconoclasts, philosophical visionaries, and religious leaders of the world.
Whether you consider yourself religious, spiritual, neither, or something in between, we invite you to take a deep dive with us down metaphysical rabbit holes and learn to see your life from a new perspective.
Hey there, Adam.
We meet once again, sir.
It's pretty regular now. I'm liking this new schedule.
It seems monthly, would you say?
I would say it's just about monthly. Yeah, absolutely. And we're really looking forward to connecting with you more. With everybody that's listening, we've gotten some new subscribers to our mailing list, and we've had people join our live calls, and it has been a blast. We're really loving the engagement that doing more of these is creating. So thank you, everybody who's listening. It means the absolute world to us.
Yeah, and the world is nothing. So
that's such a delightful, charming little anecdote you added. Thanks. Yeah, thanks, Adam.
I do my best. No, we really do appreciate everyone listening. And we do this all for you. So it's monthly now, and because of that, we get a chance to read more, engage more, and, you know, this is a really special book you're going to dive into, but I'll just say right off the bat, it's so funny, whenever I read a book, my entire life gets colored by that book, and I live the book in a certain way. All my life experiences get filtered through what I'm learning. Absolutely. And it creates such a fascinating experience of, for me, I work in the hospital. So everything that I'm normally used to now has this hue, this sort of tone to it, filtered by this beautiful book.
Absolutely.
Which is
When Things Fall Apart by Pema Chodron. And it is, I will, you know, you spoke a little bit about how your whole world is colored by it. I'm going to say this is my second favorite spiritual book of all time behind Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. I think this book has so much to offer, and it's so pithy and to the point, and there aren't a lot of wasted words. And I really love the flow of it. I love the tone of it. It's really honest and direct and loving. And I love it. If you haven't purchase this book yet and you're listening to this, you really want to read this one. Like you really want to go buy this book. It's short. It's about 200 pages. It's a quick read though. Very simple language.
150, in fact.
150. Okay. Got it. 150. Yeah. It's a nice little book, and it absolutely belongs in your life. So it's a book fundamentally about, well, as the title says, it's pretty descriptive. When things fall apart, hard advice for difficult times. So, you know, you and I, Adam, we've mentioned it several times now. I think the first time we mentioned it was in the Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism episode, where we discussed the power of disappointment. We discussed when we find ourselves experiencing something like disappointment and how difficult it is and how uncomfortable it is. That's really where the rubber starts hitting the road. And I like to think of this book as a follow-up to Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism, because this book starts right where that leaves us, with when things are falling apart, when things, we feel lost, we feel confused.
And, which is very interesting because, you know, Pema Chodron is a student of Chogyam Trungpa.
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities.
A lot of similarities, and it does make sense that there would be a continuation, generationally speaking. Well, tell me a little bit, who is Pema Chodron? Do you know her? Have you interacted with her? What experiences have you had with her? I'm sure you have.
I have met Pema Chodron. I have not spent much time with Pema at all. But Pema is an American, or she's Canadian, excuse me. She's a Canadian nun who has, you know, Chogyam Trungpa passed away a long time ago now, quite a long time ago. And so she has been kind of on her own teaching for a long time as well. And so she heads up, I believe she still heads up, Gampo Abbey in Nova Scotia, which is a nunnery, Is that what they call it? A nunnery?
Yeah.
In Chogyam Trungpa's tradition, where people can go, and there are permanent nuns living there, and you can also go there and take, you know, temporary vows and do retreats there. And I've heard it's very beautiful, but I have not been. And so she's a really amazing teacher.
You know, she calls it a monastery in her book.
Monastery. Okay, excuse me, a monastery. Nunnery feels a little bit... feels a little bit old there. I don't know why. It's like
you
an
date
aviary,
yourself, Steven.
Like place where you keep birds. So where was I? I don't even know where I was. So
Pema
is, she's, you know, she's an old woman, and but I'm
not
her
to say that, Steven.
She's an old woman, and I met her recently, and she is an absolute spitfire. She has so much energy and humor, and it's clear that something's worked. And you would be able to tell by her writing, because she's an incredible writer. And these are writings that came from her teaching, so it's an edited kind of... like a lot of teachers do, or they take their talks and then they edit them into a book. This is a really exceptional one. It really is right behind Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism.
Yeah.
For me.
Yeah, she's a Buddhist nun, but really there's something special about her life. I really felt connected in a way because she is the average Jane, right? Like average Jane Doe. She went through it all. She lived a life. She got
married
twice.
She had kids.
I believe kids. And even went through a pretty rough divorce, which incidentally initiated her decision to become a Buddhist nun, I think at the age of, you know, well, the divorce happened at around 35, 36. But she talks about it too. The experience that she had that shook her up, which in many ways forms the driving force of what she's trying to say in this book. But I'll let you continue that.
Absolutely. I mean, I guess I could talk about Pema more, but I think we should just dive in. So we've been back and forth on this over the past few days, and neither one of us really know where this is going to go. I personally have about half the book highlighted with notes everywhere. So I'm going to feel pretty lost at some point for sure, because I'm going to be looking down and finding the next highlight is, because there's too many of them. So just be ready for that. But you know, the book starts off with when things are falling apart. You know, right in the first 10 pages, we hear about a friend of Pema's who's dying of AIDS. We hear about kind of the pain that, you know, we all experience in life, and how there's no solution. There's no, you know, there's no fix for feeling pain.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think one way we can start off is her big groundlessness moment, which is with her ex-husband. I really like it because she paints a really good picture. She describes this moment where, as far as she's aware, her marriage is going just fine. And she's at her house, and she says she's holding a cup of, I think, tea, and she can it's amazing how aware she was even in that moment. She feels the steam of the tea on her face, and she looks up and she sees this beautiful clear sky, and there's a sense of presence and aliveness that just even in that description. And she goes out to the porch, and her husband is driving up to her, and he just casually comes out of the car and then tells her to her face, "I'm having an affair and I want a divorce." And she said in that moment, the ground was ripped away from her. And, you know, there was this stillness. The way she describes it, you really get a taste of, despite the shock, there's still a profound presence in that moment. And she does the appropriate thing, right? She picks up a brick and she throws it at him.
As you would.
I love that, because it's like, you know, it's not, we're all trying to be saints here, but really she's just a normal person having a normal reaction. But what surprised me was even in that moment with no training, there was a presence, there was a an awareness and the recognition of groundlessness. And I like that word groundlessness, because we have this phrase of the rug was pulled out from under my feet, you know, because there's a sense of psychologically we are so used to creating some foundation on which we stand. And part of this book, at least, and I think indeed the spiritual path, is realizing that foundation you make up in your mind. It's a construct. And when that construct falls apart, you realize there actually isn't a ground. And we talked about this once before, and you mentioned it so beautifully. It's like falling, but you never hit the ground. You're just
Chögyam Trungpa's quote that
falling.
The bad news or the good? What is it? Oh
bad
yeah, the bad
falling?
News is that you're falling and you don't have a parachute. The good news is that there is no ground. And they're alluding to groundlessness. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and in that moment, when Pema shares that. Pema starts talking about fear. Pema starts talking about, you know, fear as when we hit fear, because groundlessness kind of induces fear, that feeling of like, I don't know what's going on. I'm out of control. I've lost control of an emotion, of a thought, of a life situation, that once we meet that, that's where the path starts.
Yeah.
That is where all of the practice of the spiritual path starts.
Yeah.
And we to notice, you know, how we all are constantly searching for ground, how we'll do anything to get back to ground, you know?
Yeah.
And so I have a quote here that highlights that perfectly. Sometimes, however, we are cornered. Everything falls apart and we run out of options for escape. At times like that, the most profound spiritual truths seem pretty straightforward and ordinary. There's nowhere to hide. We see it as well as anyone else, better than anyone else. Sooner or later, we understand that although we can't make fear look pretty, it will nevertheless introduce us to all the teaching we've ever heard or read.
Love it.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I don't know about, I would love to hear more about your experience reading this book, Adam. For me, this book did something to me when I read it this time. I've read this book, this is probably my third time through this book, and I loved it from the start, but it did something to me this time. For a long time in my life, I have been, it's going to sound like I'm finding ground, but give me a break here. For a long time in my personal spiritual life, I have felt like that I had a personal gap between the height of experiences and the profound truths that you know, I've been fortunate enough to glimpse, and everyday life. And I've found ways to kind of force stitch those together, I feel, at times. But it's all been pretty intellectual. I've struggled to bring it into my body, for lack of a better word, that wisdom. For some reason, this time when I read this book, it put me right into my body and right in touch with the experiences that were happening right now in a way that I've never experienced before. And it feels so much simpler and so much more tangible and palpable than a lot of the other high quote unquote experiences that I've had, you know, going through this book. And we're going to get into it. You're talking about fear, discomfort, uncertainty, you know, just sitting with it. Like, you know, I've just been sitting with, okay, I'm not going to distract myself. I'm not going to look at my phone, which again is nothing new. The practice of like not picking up your phone when you want to look at your phone is not a new practice, you know, like these little things. But I've just been so present with exactly what I'm feeling and what's going on and the discomfort and the urge to fix it, the urge to find a solution for that discomfort. And I think in the past, even when I would do that, I would always try to come back to a state of peacefulness. I would say, okay, I'm noticing my discomfort so I can get back to a state of peacefulness. You know, like there was an end goal that I was going for by doing this practice. And something about this time through the book, like you were saying, your whole life has been colored. You know, when you read one of these books, like, you know, whole life gets colored like that for a while. I have found that it's right there for me. And I'm seeing how my habit to get out of discomfort, even when I'm noticing discomfort, you know, if I'm tense, instead of saying, okay, I got to notice the tension so that I can relax. Yeah. It's just, no, I just have to notice the tension and experience what it feels like to be tense. And that becomes the whole moment. It's become the whole moment for me. And so there's no concept of present. There's no concept of future or past. It's just this moment of tension, and I don't have to run away from it. I can just, you know, I don't know. It's just, it's been really, really profound in a very visceral, embodied way that I've never experienced before. And so I'm really grateful that I suggested we do this book.
Yeah, I hear you. I really agree with what you're saying. And Steve, and I just really want to say what you're describing is, it just occurred to me, we are going against something so profoundly hardwired biologically. Even something as simple as an amoeba, it will move away from pain. It will move towards food, right? It is so deeply ingrained into biological structure, right? DNA and whatnot. And psychologically, we still do that. Only it's happening internally. The negative thoughts that we have, oh, I don't want to have that. Let me move away. Let me bury it, push it away, ignore it. You know, and the movement towards peace. Let me find that something that makes me happy. It is so natural and a part of being human. And what's being asked of us here is to consider that there isn't anywhere you need to go. Internally.
Yeah.
And for me, I've had a similar experience with this book. I've had a pretty rough week in the hospital, in the ICU, with interpersonal challenges as well as very difficult cases with the patients. And, you know, so much goes on internally as a physician with wondering whether your management is optimal for the patient and handling, you know, very dense, for lack of a better word, emotional situations with families. And reading this book made me feel that I didn't need to move anywhere inside of me. Whatever was showing up, you know, like, you know, oh my God, this, the daughter of this patient is screaming in my face because she thinks we're killing her dad, and just standing there and feeling my body, you know, want to run away, right? And feeling the tension in my heart, and then feeling like, no, there's nowhere I need to go, and feeling this, and what I think happens is, instead of moving towards peace, wanting something better than the suffering, the being present, for me at least, being present with that intensity, emotional intensity, the natural consequence is peace, because then it's I'm not trying anymore. If that makes sense, right? There's a total allowing of the present moment. I don't always get there, but that was one instance where I felt like the complete dropping of trying to get away from the discomfort, the consequence was peace, not something I was striving for.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I have
one more quote.
I have another quote.
We'll leave it. I got one too. But you go first.
Okay, I appreciate
this.
It.
This is a quote. This is turning into a quote off.
We haven't had a good old fashioned quote off in a while, sir. All right. Basically, Disappointment, embarrassment, and all these places where we just cannot feel good are a sort of death. We've just lost our ground completely. We are unable to hold it together and feel that we're on top of things. Rather than realizing that it takes death for there to be birth, we just fight against the fear of death. Reaching our limit is not some kind of punishment. It's actually a sign of health, that when we meet the place where we are about to die, we feel fear and trembling. A further sign of health is that we don't become undone by fear and trembling, but we take it as a message that it's time to stop struggling and look directly at what's threatening us. Things like disappointment and anxiety are messengers telling us that we're about to go into unknown territory.
Yeah, messengers. This is a theme that keeps coming up in all of her work, and especially this book, is every quote-unquote negative thing that happens in life is the way. That's the tool. That's what needs to be used and embraced and moved through. It's interesting because it's a, you know, Ryan Holiday talks about this, the obstacle is the way. It's a very classic teaching. It's present in Stoicism. I know we've had an episode on Stoicism. But I just realized how we don't actually live that way. The majority of us, and even those who are aware of that teaching, we don't practice it as often as perhaps we can. We have gold mines in front of us. Every negative emotion, every challenge, that's a stepping stone.
Yeah. And it's
okay, my turn.
Okay, fine. Go ahead. Whatever.
Okay.
It better be good.
Well,
it will be good. Just kidding.
It's her. One thing that I want to emphasize is there's this moment, and it keeps coming up in life. It's this moment where shit hits the fan, things fall apart. We get to the point where nothing makes sense anymore, and we are fed up. We are fed up. That is such a rich, rich place to be in. And in my experience, granted, it's a n size of one. It's a single anecdote from me personally. But I have noticed when that happens, the most profound spiritual progress is made. If that moment is seen properly. So there's actually a word for that. In Tibetan, there's an interesting word. Ye tang che. The ye part means totally, completely, and the rest of it means exhausted. Altogether, ye tang che means totally tired out. We might say totally fed up. It describes an experience of complete hopelessness, of completely giving up hope. This is an important point. This is the beginning of the beginning. Without giving up hope that there's somewhere better to be, that there's someone better to be, we will never relax with where we are or who we are.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. Super huge and very important. I resonated so much with that. It's happened to me like two or three times in my life already of hopelessness and despair and everything falling apart. And there was, in my case, there was nowhere else to go. And I had to just be with who I was in that moment.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, I had everything you're describing, that same experience when my brother died. I mean, I had literally nowhere to go. I mean, I was facing my own death for sure. And absolutely. I completely, it's an N size of two now, my friend. I think, I think that's the great thing about these kind of spiritual truths is that what we find in ourselves, we tend to, you know, other people relate to.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there's at least one other person listening to this that has experienced that too.
Yeah.
Maybe one, maybe two.
Just one other person in the whole world.
Well, this gets to, what comes to mind, I want to go into Pema's discussions of Maitri there and how we start to dissolve those things, how we start to dissolve those hard edges. But really,
well, what is Maitri?
Yeah, we're going to get there. Hold on. We're going to get there. Maitri is loving kindness. And we're going to get there. Okay. I'm going to do another quote, though.
Okay. Okay. Cool.
We're getting serious. In the teachings of Buddhism, we hear about egolessness. It sounds difficult to grasp. What are they talking about anyway? When the teachings are about neuroses, however, we feel right at home. That's something we really understand. But egolessness? When we reach our limit, if we aspire to know that place fully, which is to say that we aspire to neither indulge nor repress, a hardness in us will dissolve. We will be softened by the sheer force of whatever energy arises, the energy of anger, the energy of disappointment, the energy of fear. When it's not solidified in one direction or another, that very energy pierces us to the heart and it opens us. This is the discovery of egolessness. It's when all our usual schemes fall apart. Reaching our limit is like finding a doorway to sanity and the unconditional goodness of humanity, rather than meeting an obstacle or a punishment. And I've, you know, Pema talks about, in this book, Pema talks about how, like, realizing how crazy our normal lives are. Like, how, like, our entire, like you said, an amoeba, even an amoeba runs away from pain.
Yeah.
And run, like, an amoeba doesn't have a brain. You know, an amoeba doesn't have a brain, and it still does this. It's so hard. It's hardwired into us to do this. And our whole world looks like it. You know, when we are not on a spiritual path, that's the wrong thing to say, but like everywhere in our lives, we encounter this. The whole world is built like this. The world is built to avoid pain, to avoid frustration. That's how everything is designed. And it's crazy because if you like try these practices and you just sit with the disappointment, the frustration, the tension, and you just don't try to force it away and you don't try to hang on to it, like it softens you. And it's there's nothing else to do. That's the whole path, man. Like that's it. And it's right there. And every single moment of our lives, and that, you know, we get to the end of the book, the path is the goal. But you know, that's what there is. Like you said, there's nowhere else to be. There's no better place to be. You have to give up. You don't have to give up, but you know, maybe you'll come to realize that there's no better place to be than exactly where you are, because no matter where you are, you'll have to experience the same types of things, the same thing, whether it's here or somewhere else. So and I'm going to find a quote about Maitri. We're going to talk about Maitri next for sure.
Yeah,
loving kindness.
All right. So this jumps a little bit ahead, but it speaks to what you're saying, and the idea that she's conveying at this part is, you may want to try to change things in your life, improve your relationships, etc., help others, this sort of thing. But all of it ultimately, or at the very beginning, it starts with you. If you can have kindness to yourself, love yourself, be compassionate to yourself, if you can generate enough space to allow these negative emotions to be and not push them away or deny them, then you'll find, again, as a natural consequence, that love and freedom and openness starts to be expressed in your relationships and those around you. So let me read the quote here. This leads to a bigger underlying issue for all of us. How are we ever going to change anything? How is there going to be less aggression in the universe rather than more? We can then bring it down to a more personal level. How do I learn to communicate with somebody who is hurting me or someone who is hurting a lot of people? How do I speak to someone so that some change actually occurs? How do I communicate so that the space opens up and both of us begin to touch into some kind of basic intelligence that we all share? In a potentially violent encounter, how do I communicate so that neither of us becomes increasingly furious and aggressive? How do I communicate to the heart so that a stuck situation can ventilate? How do I communicate so that the things that seem frozen, unworkable, and eternally aggressive begin to soften up? and some kind of compassionate exchange begins to happen. Well, it starts with being willing to feel what we are going through. It starts with being willing to have a compassionate relationship with the parts of ourselves that we feel are not worthy of existing on the planet. If we are willing through meditation to be mindful not only of what feels comfortable, but also of what pain feels like, if we even aspire to stay awake and open to what we're feeling, to recognize and acknowledge it as best we can in each moment, then something begins to change. Compassionate action, being there for others, being able to act and speak in a way that communicates, starts with seeing ourselves when we start to make ourselves right or make ourselves wrong. And seeing ourselves, and that's the quote, and seeing ourselves is all of it, in my experience, to just, as she said, meditate and see myself, witness myself, be present to myself, and not need to change anything. If I can have that much compassion for myself, and God knows I have messed up a lot in life. I've made mistakes. I've done things I shouldn't have done, said things I shouldn't have said. And there's guilt, right, that arises naturally in that. But if I can be that compassionate to myself, it's bound to spill over to every relationship I have, to have compassion for others as well.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I want to follow that up. I think I know the quote you're going to read because it's very similar, but it's earlier in the book. But before I do that, that compassion for ourselves, that's when we, you know, everyone feels guilt. Like as Pema says, everyone feels guilt. Everyone feels fear. Everyone feels uncomfortable. Everyone feels loss. Everyone feels shame. Like, it's okay to feel those things. Mm-hmm. It is a perfectly, that is a normal human experience. Like that is, everybody experiences those things. So you don't have to run from them. You don't have to hide from them. You don't have to pretend they don't happen to you. And you can just experience, what does shame feel like? Is it hot? Is it cold? Is it tense in my shoulders? Is it tense in my belly? Is it tense in my head? Does it come all with other things? Does it have colors? Does it have smells? Does it have sounds?
Mm.
You know, what do those emotions feel like inside of, you know, inside? And that's when you start to like know yourself. You start to know yourself once you know those things. And I've encountered this a lot just through my own practice, but this kind of concept of used in this book, it's a very Buddhist thing, making friends with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, you know, this what I was describing earlier, kind of some of the shifts that his book has started in me, for lack of a better word. When I start to find out what is the color of shame, what is the sound of, you know, remorse, I start to make friends with myself. It stops being scary. It's like, yeah, I know exactly what guilt feels like, and I know everything about guilt in me, and I don't have to be afraid of it. It's just like, hey, wow, you're there. Like I know you so well. I don't have to react to you. I just like, wow, it's this guilt coming up again. And isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
So I want to dive into this one then. This quote: because we have basic goodness, basic wisdom, basic intelligence, we can stop harming ourselves and harming others. Because of mindfulness, we see things when they arise. Because of our understanding, we don't buy into the chain reaction that makes things grow from minute to expansive. We leave things minute. They stay tiny. They don't keep expanding into World War III or domestic violence. It all comes through learning to pause for a moment, learning not just to impulsively do the same thing again and again. It's a transformative experience to simply pause instead of immediately filling up the space. By waiting, we begin to connect with fundamental restlessness as well as fundamental spaciousness. The result is that we cease to cause harm. We begin to know ourselves thoroughly and to respect ourselves. Anything can come up. Anything can walk into our house. We can find anything sitting on our living room couch, and we don't freak out.
That's a great analogy to have your inner world be a house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know, what if you do walk in and like your house is in shambles and the furniture is all over the place and there's clothes on the ground?
Yeah,
that's a great way of looking at things. In many ways, we do have an interior castle, don't we?
We have an interior castle. But back to loving kindness. So the word Maitri is means loving kindness, and it is it's very descriptive. It's a very descriptive word, loving kindness. So this is a practice that we do to generate loving kindness for ourselves, to have compassion for ourselves, to let us know that, you know, it's who we are is okay, what we're going through is okay, and there's nothing wrong with us.
Yeah.
So this is a really important practice for Prema, and you know, for me before I knew Prema, is this generating this loving kindness for ourselves, and there are many ways to do that, and I kind of relate it to bodhicitta. Prema talks about them separately in terms of how they arrive in the book. But, Prema talks about Tonglen, which I know you and I have talked about before, sending and
receiving.
Taking. Yeah. And we're jumping too far ahead. I don't know. Do you think we're jumping too far ahead?
There's a lot of ideas that you threw there. I didn't want to talk about.
I did. Yeah.
That was like a dense thought bubble all of a sudden. It's, you had like five concepts all at once. Okay, before we go into Tonglen, I want to make a point here, which I'm so glad that Pema brought up. When being kind to oneself goes a little too far, and this is where we need to have vigilance and awareness of ourselves. She had this example of a student who was with her meditating in a course or a workshop or something like that, and everyone was sitting on the floor on meditation cushions or whatnot, and this woman decides to get up and like lie down, and then later on Pema went to her and asked her, I noticed you were lying down during the meditation, and she said, yeah, I decided to be kind to myself and lie down instead of sitting up because it was uncomfortable. And that's innocuous. It's simple. But Pema realized in that moment that there's also the need for discipline. And she talks about that at length in the book. There's a balance there, right? Like in many things in Buddhism, there's this balance internally where we can't go too far on one end or too far on one extreme, right? There's whole concept of the middle way. And I think this applies here too. Being kind to yourself is a must when there's intense suffering. We have to be present with ourselves and honor and respect ourselves. But if there's a slight discomfort and that discomfort pulls us away from the desire to, let's say we want to meditate and we feel uncomfortable, right, to just be still. Being kind to yourself doesn't mean stopping the meditation or lying down and taking a break, right?
Mm-hmm.
Truly being kind to yourself means you aspire for that deep peace, which means you'll have the discipline to sit still in a meditation posture and have the courage to face the discomfort of what's arising. And it's funny because it's like you can't teach that very well. It's a subtlety in the awareness, but eventually when one does that often enough, you'll start to recognize when the ego mind is trying to tear us away from doing the work. Something is trying to pull us away into ignorance and unconsciousness, right? Instead of being mindful and present and aware and facing that discomfort.
Yeah. And Pema talks about discipline and kind of the knowing of, I'm just going to restate what you said if I just keep talking, but then also about, to go back to the other side of it, which is that we all have unawareness. We all do that. Every one of us falls into that pattern.
Yeah, we do.
Every single person. And that's okay too. It's okay to have that experience. And the important part from Pema's perspective, and I think the spiritual path's perspective, is to come back to awareness, is to keep moving, is to keep reflecting.
Yeah. So there's this other thing that you mentioned, Tonglen. I know we did talk about it, but just refresh me and our listeners. What is Tonglen in Buddhism? What's the purpose behind the practice? And what does Pema say about it?
Yeah, so this is kind of going from memory. I don't have a lot highlighted. It's in the book. If you do, let me know.
I just have
some experience with it. So in particular, I've listened to some of Pema's talks about it. So Tonglen is called sending and taking. There's many different names for it, but on the surface, it is oftentimes described as a way to generate more love to what's called bodhicitta. So bodhicitta is kind of this combination of words that means heart mind, and it's not the same as loving kindness and like maitri, and like literally they're different words, but it's the same kind of concept of generating goodwill and stretching. And so that's the surface level of it. But Pema talks about kind of the deeper level of it is to find places where we're uncomfortable, you know? And so in the book, she talks about someone who, a friend of hers who was, had a young child and turned on the TV and saw the Oklahoma City bombings and saw a firefighter carrying a toddler's body out of a building. And just he just felt to breathe in all of the pain of all the parents and what they were feeling at that moment, because to go through that with the child. And so he just started breathing. And so Tonglen is a practice. We use the breath and we breathe in the pain that people are experiencing. And it can be a single person. It could be like, Adam, if I know you're going through something, I could breathe in what you're experiencing. And I breathe out and I radiate cool peace. And so we can then start to stretch it. So for this gentleman who had this experience, he's breathing in all of the pain of parents that are going through this horrible suffering right now. And he's breathing out to them cool peace and relief from that pain. What happens is, one, it's a beautiful practice for generating the feeling of love, of bodhicitta. And at the same time, it also tells us where we still what we still have to work on, because we might come to a point where, let's say, we're having a tough time at work and our boss or a colleague, and we're like, I don't think I want to offer them anything right now. I don't think I really want to breathe in, not take on their pain, because that's not what it is, but breathe in that pain that they're going through. And that tells us something. It tells us where we need to continue working. And so it has both of those aspects. But to start, just, you know, it's just a really wonderful practice to start feeling with other people. And just, it's compassion. That's, you know, bodhicitta is compassion, for lack of a better word. It's not, a lot of times people, and Pema talks about this, they associate the word compassion with people that are less fortunate than us, or, you know, like lesser than us, like, oh, those poor people. But Pema says very clearly that it's about our shared humanity. It's about our shared pain. It doesn't have to be that I'm, you know, just because I'm not having that experience that someone else isn't. And I mm-hmm. can breathe, I can use my breath to move that, to move that through myself and to start generating compassion, the feeling of compassion.
Yeah, I have a quote here. So for those of you who are listening and you want to give this a shot, you want to practice Tonglen and practice what Pema is offering here, I'm going to read a quote here, and these are some instructions for how you can practice it. The practice of Tonglen, sending and receiving, is designed to awaken bodhicitta, to put us in touch with genuine, noble heart. It is a practice of taking in pain and sending out pleasure, and therefore completely turns around our well-established habit of doing just the opposite. Tonglen is a practice of creating space, ventilating the atmosphere of our lives so that people can breathe freely and relax. Whenever we encounter suffering in any form, the Tonglen instruction is to breathe it in with the wish that everyone could be free of pain. Whenever we encounter happiness in any form, the instruction is to breathe it out, send it out, with the wish that everyone could feel joy. It's a practice that allows people to feel less burdened and less cramped, a practice that shows us how to love without conditions. I like it because there's a deep philosophical meaning to it, right? The breathing in, not only is there an actual breathing in practice, but it's symbolic of you understand the suffering of your brothers and sisters. Like you get it. You feel it because you've suffered yourself too. There's a shared interest. There's a shared understanding amongst you. And when you can see the other as yourself, when you can see those shared interests, those shared experiences, that universal experience of not only the suffering of humanity, but the aspiration towards no longer suffering, it creates a sense, it creates a deep bond. It's harder to demonize another person when you have that sense of, oh, you're just like me, right? When everyone becomes part of your tribe, you can't ostracize anymore, which is, it's powerful. And that's the breathing in. And then philosophically, the breathing out is truly, truly, genuinely wishing happiness upon everyone. And because if everyone is like me and I want to be happy, then let me wish happiness on everyone else. And that's the breathing out. The natural tendency is the opposite, right? I want happiness for myself and not for the person that I'm upset at. And I don't really want to have anything to do with them. So this is a great way to reverse habitual tendencies. And practically speaking, it's a good thing to breathe deeply.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, just to stop and take a breath.
Yeah. Yeah. And it creates, like you were saying, I just want to go into that creating space a little bit more. So this whole time we started off, and this is kind of the beauty of this book, as Pema's really able to tie concepts together, is we started off talking about how we have this fundamental aversion or attraction. So we're either moving towards something we like or towards away from something we don't like. Even an amoeba will do it. And when we practice Tonglen and we find this shared experience with other people, I find for myself that when I'm in that state, I'm a lot less jumpy towards running away or towards things. I there's a lot more space in my aversion or attachment, for lack of a better, you know, a more graceful way of sending that. So it's, you know, when someone's feeling something horrible, or not even something horrible, you don't have to be that drastic, but someone else has experienced discomfort, they're experiencing frustration, they're experiencing fear, I have done that practice, and I know that, yeah, that really sucks. It really, like, and I know exactly what that feels like. I know what it's like to experience fear and discomfort. And yeah. And I don't have to, because a lot of times when other people experience strong emotions, we react to it. Just like you were sharing earlier with a patient's family member. I'm sure that happens all the time to you. You know, people have extremely strong emotions. And when they do, our natural tendency is to run away from it. Or if it's a really good thing, to run towards it and find out how do we get some.
Yeah.
but that, when I find when I do Tonglen, it really gives me a chance to create space in that moving aversion or attachment.
Yeah, I'm going back to this situation with you know, the daughter of this man. So he really had, I don't want to go into the details, but let's say he's multi-organ failure. He was at the end of his life, and the daughter, instead of being present and really feeling the profound grief of knowing she's about to lose her father, was uncomfortable with that. And so pushed the grief down, denied it, and then projected it out onto me and made his inevitable death my fault. And the fault of the nurses and the hospital, and you know, but it was someone else's fault. It wasn't just that he was dying because it was his time. Someone had to be at fault. And I think now, looking back over it, immense compassion for her. I've seen enough people suffer over the death of their loved ones to totally and completely understand. I get it. It is so painful that I've seen the craziest things. People do the craziest things when they know that their loved one is about to die. The stories I could tell. But I recognize that immediately in the moment. She is hurting. She's hurting. And I do think at the same time, if each of us can take a moment and find that place where we are so uncomfortable and to give it space, as you said, like really a healthy amount of spaciousness and just allow that feeling to be, it stops being scary. It stops being a behemoth in front of us. It becomes a will-o'-the-wisp, like light. The heaviness goes away. It becomes airy almost. It's hard to describe, but I'm just sharing from my personal experience. If I just create the space and stop resisting, it loses its substance. The intensity of the emotion loses its substance. And then I can just be present with my own awareness that's underneath it all, the blue sky that is behind the clouds, the dark, stormy clouds, so to speak. And if we did that, if we were aware of all of that, what we would notice is that there's no longer a desire to deny. There's no longer a desire to push away. And then the projection doesn't happen. The blaming, the attack doesn't happen. How much suffering can be averted? How much aggression in this world could be relieved if we're all just willing to be present with the intensity of the emotions? Okay, I'm getting off my soapbox.
It's my turn. So one of the things, you know, Pema Chodron uses the term spiritual warrior. Bodhisattva is the more traditional word for that. And it's Chogyam Trungpa used the word spiritual warrior. But so, okay, we've been talking about when things happen to us and, you know, we have the unexpected happen. But how do you and I, how do I as a practitioner seek out opportunities? So one, we've been talking about this entire time, every single moment is an opportunity. There's no reason to go, quote unquote, seek out something. But in Buddhism, they have a concept of seeking out discomfort in order to deal with it, to force oneself to deal with it. And there are all sorts of crazy stories about absolute extremes of this, and they're not terribly useful. But one thing I want to talk about is the charnel ground. And so the charnel ground is a graveyard. And as Pema says, graveyards in Tibet are not nearly as pretty as graveyards in the Western world. So in Tibet, the ground is frozen for most of the year. And so there's nowhere to bury the dead. And so what happens when someone dies, they're cut up and they're fed to the vultures. And so there's fields where there are bodies that are partially decomposed and partially eaten. And that is, it's called a sky burial. And so this the concept called the charnel ground. So in India, it would be where they're burning bodies at a ghat. Like on the River Ganges, they burn bodies. You can go sit right next to it happening. I've done that, and you can just experience it. And so there's, you know, this again is a little bit of an extreme example because not everyone has access to this. I don't have access to this. The best I can do right now is a pretty American graveyard, but you know, we can think about where are the places that we're uncomfortable. Where are the places that it's, you know, we know it'll provoke a reaction in us. And that's, you know, not in a way that's if I go piss this person off, they're going to get mad at me, and then I'm going to get to experience being yelled at, and that's somehow training for me. That's not what I'm talking about. There's a skill to it. okay, so we as bodhisattvas, as spiritual warriors, we have to be brave, and we have to look for opportunities to practice. And that's a part of the path, because the more opportunities, it's like working out, it's like doing anything. The more reps you have, the better you get at it. And anything anyone wants to get better at. And the issue is that it's so uncomfortable. Yeah. This kind, what we're talking about, like it takes a bit of a masochistic mindset, if I'm being honest. Like you gotta be willing to like jump into some discomfort. And
see, this is why
you could be knitting instead, or embroidering, and you know, putting those reps into something beautiful. That's still lovely too. We should all take up embroidery and knitting. I don't mean to knock it, but this is what I'm saying. You know, we got to put the reps in. We have to take on opportunities and find opportunities to experience these things, to practice with them.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is why it's so important to be, to meditate regularly. Meditation, I think, if I could just drop that word, I think, and then replace it with just, as the Zen Buddhists would say, just sit down, just stop what you're doing, be present with what's happening inside. If you stop long enough, all of that stuff, all of that buried pain, it's underneath the surface. And it's not that far deep. It's right there. All the terrible things that happened earlier on in your life, maybe recently or maybe a long time ago, if you stop long enough, if you create enough silence in your mind, you will see what's there. And then the question is, how do you relate to that? How do you create space for what arises? The other thing I would say, too, is... you don't need, in my experience, I could be wrong about this. In my personal experience, you don't need to hunt for the Definitely. Challenges. Just Definitely. Wait. It usually doesn't take more than 24 hours, 48 hours. Something is going to happen that will knock you off course, and it will be a challenge. You just have to wait. That life is that. Life is that. It will always bring you something to work with. So now I just let it come. Okay, I do have something else I want to cover, though. This is going to be a little bit of a longer episode, but I want to address something that I thought was really important, which is loneliness. Because I think it...
Oh my God, so good.
Yeah, it was something that really affected me when I was younger, and I just read this, and it really touched us... a heartstring, and brought up some painful memories. But it also, I know it's something that is so endemic. It's such a huge part of modern culture, exacerbated, I feel, by the way we interact with each other through social media, the layers, the digital layers that we place between us, the screens, and as well as the facades that we put up to others, but also to ourselves, right? Like, how often do we scroll through our own pictures on our social media feed just to make sure that we look okay to ourselves, right? So I just wanted to talk a little bit about loneliness, because it's so...
There's an entire chapter called Six Kinds of Loneliness.
Yes, there is. Highly recommend reading that, or reading the whole thing. But I'm going to read a portion of it here. Okay. Usually, we regard loneliness as an enemy. Heartache is not something we choose to invite in. It's restless and pregnant and hot with a desire to escape and find something or someone to keep us company. When we can rest in the middle, we begin to have a non-threatening relationship with loneliness, a relaxing and cooling loneliness that completely turns our usual fearful patterns upside down. And then she goes in to talk about six different kinds of cool loneliness. I like that she uses the word hot and cold. and I'm just going to skip ahead to the next page here. When we are lonely in a, quote, hot way, we look for something to save us. We look for a way out. We get this queasy feeling that we call loneliness, and our minds just go wild trying to come up with companions to save us from despair. That's called unnecessary activity. It's a way of keeping ourselves busy so we don't have to feel any pain. It could take the form of obsessively daydreaming of true romance, or turning a tidbit of gossip into the 6 o'clock news, or even going off by ourselves into the wilderness. The point is that in all these activities, we are seeking companionship in our usual habitual way, using our same old repetitive ways of distancing ourselves from the demon of loneliness. Could we just settle down and have some compassion and respect for ourselves? Could we stop trying to escape from being alone with ourselves? What about practicing not jumping and grabbing when we begin to panic? Relaxing with loneliness is a worthy occupation. As the Japanese poet Ryokan says, if you want to find the meaning, stop chasing after so many things. I liked that because it's so universal. We all suffer loneliness from one in one way or another at one point in time or another. I certainly have. And there's, for me, there's like the despair of loneliness. And there's also like day-to-day loneliness. Like, you know, you were just with someone and now you're by yourself, but you don't really want to be just by yourself. So you'll grab your phone, you'll go on Netflix, you'll, you know, like some activity. And she was speaking to that a little bit, like you fill in that empty space with activity. And I think somewhere else in the book, she said, we're all alone. We're always all alone. We're with ourselves all the time. We'll die alone, right? Yes, there's going to be people with us, but we are with ourselves even in that moment. And my big takeaway with this and rereading it is it's okay to be alone. It's okay. There's enough space and kindness and compassion in me after having cultivated that I'm okay to be with myself. And many of us aren't there yet. That's something that needs to be cultivated and practiced. But that's something that's precious and valuable, to be okay to be with yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. I really struggled with this when I was younger, in my 20s. I'm in my mid-20s. I really, really struggled with loneliness, for sure. I realized I could not be alone. I think it's naturally shifted for me over time. I don't think I intentionally worked on it ever. But, you know, for me, that feeling of loneliness is, it relates to death, I think. You know, like, there's a quote that she says of Shunryu Suzuki, who says, when we're born, being born is like getting on a boat and going out to sea, knowing the boat is going to sink. Like there's one direction we're all headed, and it's sad. Like there's a part of that that's very sad and lonely. You know, like there's no sugarcoating that. There really isn't. And so, like, exactly what you said, so many of the ways that we distract ourselves from what's going on, it's not even like explicitly the fear of death. It's, you know, it's not like I'm trying to distract myself because I don't want to think about my own death. It's any of that discomfort is a small death. Like that the little like gnawing voice that says pick up the phone or whatever, you know, is we're avoiding something. And it's not fine, you can make it about we're avoiding our own death or whatever, blah blah blah, but it's, you know, for me it's that discomfort is a small death. It's something we're avoiding, we're pushing away from, we're running from, just like the amoeba. And it's only one way we're going.
Yeah. The Sufis, there's a phrase that I hold dear to my heart, which is One is blessed if one dies before one dies.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And I like that. There's a deep meaning to that. There's a very, very deep meaning to it. And we're speaking to it a little bit in many different ways. Their death is in front of us. And we have to have the courage to face it and allow ourselves to die. And obviously, I'm speaking metaphorically here, but die before we die. And when that happens, I know you've had your own personal experiences with awakening, as have I. There is an awareness that when that death happened, that first death, right, before physical death, you realize that what's present always has been, and it will never not be. And when that awareness arises, for me, there's an immense comfort.
Mm-hmm.
I can just settle knowing what was always will be, and it will never not be.
Hmm. 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 Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Well, that takes us to the end of the book, which is about the path is the goal. And so I myself have, I mean, most of the time in my life, I'm guilty of this, of thinking that there's an end, of thinking that there's somewhere else that the practice is supposed to get me to. And
but there is. It's level 60.
Level 60.
Of the meditation power.
Yeah, I'm almost there. Give me a few more years. So I think, you know, back in the beginning of this call, of this chat, I spoke about kind of the real embodiment that I felt start to take place since reading this book this time. I think when people said the practice is the path is the goal, the practice is the path is another way of saying that, I honestly never really related to that, because always for me there was something else. There was that, as I'm saying, this is why I'm saying it was very intellectual for me. There's this some else place out there that I was going to get to. And I think that now I have a much better relationship, or a relationship, any relationship with that term, the path is the goal, or the practice is the path, is that there's literally nowhere else to go. Like, your experience is the goal. Like, you being in touch with your own experience and your whatever you're going through is the goal. That's it. The wisdom, the awakened enlightenment, for lack of a better word, is found there, if anywhere. That's the only place there is. And there's a couple stories I want to share that Pema shared at the end of the book that I think are really poignant. And I'll share the first one. And so, speaking about Chogyam Trungpa and his teacher, so Chogyam Trungpa ran away from the Chinese invasion, and when he was very young, I think he was a teenager, but he had a teacher, obviously, in Tibet, and so someone asked him what happened to his teacher, and he said, "I honestly don't know, but I did hear from somebody that the last time he was seen, he was walking towards China." And I was, that blew my mind. It's like, talk about a warrior, talk about someone who is the practice is the path, as everyone else is running and he's walking towards pain. Wow. He's walking towards the complete unknown. So that really touched me. And then the second one, I'll just read this quote. It's towards the end of the book here. "When we realize that the path is the goal, there's a sense of workability. Trungpa Rinpoche said, whatever occurs in the confused mind is regarded as the path. Everything is workable. It is a fearless proclamation, the lion's roar. Everything that occurs in our confused mind, we can regard as the path. Everything is workable. If we find ourselves in what seems like a rotten or painful situation and we think, well, how is this enlightenment? We can just remember this notion of the path, that what seems undesirable in our lives doesn't have to put us to sleep. What seems undesirable in our lives doesn't have to trigger habitual reactions. We can let it show us where we're at, and we can let it remind us that the teachings encourage precision and gentleness, with loving kindness toward every moment. When we live this way, we feel frequently, maybe continuously, at a crossroads, never knowing what's ahead. It's an insecure way to live. We often find ourselves in the middle of a dilemma. What should I do about the fact that somebody's angry with me? What should I do about the fact that I'm angry with somebody? Basically, the instruction is not to try to solve the problem, but instead to use it as a question about how to let this very situation wake us up further, rather than lull us into ignorance. We can use a difficult situation to encourage ourselves to take a leap, to step out into that ambiguity. This teaching applies even to the most horrendous situations in life. Jean-Paul Sartre said that there are two ways to go to the gas chamber, free or not free. This is our choice in every moment. Do we relate to the circumstances with bitterness or with openness? That is why it can be said that whatever occurs can be regarded as the path, and that all things, not just some things, are workable. This teaching is a fearless proclamation of what's possible for ordinary people like you and me.
Fearless. That's great. Thank you. Thank you, Stephen. That's a great way to wrap this up. I'm so inspired by people like Pema Chodron, who have gone through so much in their own personal lives and have come through it in order to offer these teachings to us and to other people in a world that's so lacking in many ways of authenticity and genuineness. This is such a refreshing book and such a refreshing read to truly hear from someone who is deeply genuine, and it does nothing but inspire me to be the same way, to be genuine with myself, to be authentic with myself, and have so much space to be compassionate with anything that arises. It's like there's a freedom to, I can be whoever I am in any moment, and whatever arises, there is plenty of space for me to be just that, and it feels freeing.
Yeah. Absolutely. I'm left with the same experience, and I couldn't put it better myself. So if you're listening to this and any of this has sounded interesting to you, please pick up this book. I promise you will not be disappointed. It can be a challenging book, but it's so worth it. And I hope you'll read it and that you'll come away just as inspired as Adam and I have been today. And as I think, as Pema does, I would love to close out this episode just dedicating all of the wisdom and all of the Buddhists would say the merit that we've accumulated by having this conversation and satsanging together like this to the awakening of all beings everywhere.
In a classic Judeo-Christian sense, amen.
Amen. All right. I'll talk to you soon, Adam.
Yeah, take care, Stephen.
Bye.
Bye.